The Sword of Fire, Book 1, Azulon, by William R. McGrath. Copyright 2007, William R. McGrath. Narration by James H. Brinkley. Chapter 2, The Trihex, Part 2.
"The food,"
Daniel said at the end of the meal,
"was nearly as good as seeing your ugly old faces again."
One of the young men grabbed the face of his neighbour in both his hands, distorting it, and said,
"Who are you calling old?"
They all laughed. A boy in the dark green tunic of a squire in training came up to a paladin captain, who then pointed out Daniel. The boy of 12 years or so marched up to Daniel with a serious face and bowed.
"Prince Daniel?"
"Yes, lad,"
said Daniel, looking down at the boy.
"The king wishes your presence in his chambers, sir."
Daniel had to smile at the boy's manner.
"What is your name, lad?"
"Tompkins, sir,"
said the boy.
"Well, Tompkin, I'm new to the fortress, and need the assistance of an experienced man to guide me hence."
The boy stood a bit taller.
"Sir, I can guide you. I know this old place like I know my mum's own kitchen."
"Well then, Sir Guide, lead on,"
said Daniel, knowing Tompkin would be the hero at the table of the junior squires that night. Daniel's friends shouted their goodbyes as the prince followed the boy out of the dining hall. They made their way back, past the throne room, and to a large oak door at the end of the hallway. Two paladins were standing guard before it with a servant in Chamberlain's livery.
"Prince Daniel to see the king,"
said Tompkin, doing his best to deepen his voice. The servant looked down past his long nose at the boy and cocked an eyebrow.
"If you please, sir,"
added Tompkin. The servant rapped 3 times with the big brass knocker set on the door, opened it and announced,
"Prince Daniel to see the king."
Daniel turned to Tompkin and saluted him in the manner of the paladins, right fist over the heart.
"Thank you, Sir Guide, you have done well. Dismissed."
Tompkin snapped to attention and saluted smartly, but could not keep the smile off his face. Daniel turned and entered the room. Argius rose from behind a large oak table.
"Well, son, have your friends so filled your belly and your ears that you are too full to drink and talk with your father and an old friend?"
Hanging from a peg on the wall behind Argius was a crook-topped shepherd's staff of hickory wood, an old leather bag, and a battered sailcloth pilgrim's hat. A hat that was wide-brimmed, flat-topped and bleached nearly white by many years in the sun. Daniel remembered that hat. Argius nodded towards the other side of the room. Daniel spun round and cried out,
"Simon!"
Standing by the hearth was an old brown bear of a man. His tunic and trousers were the colour of ripe wheat. A wide leather belt was around his thick waist, and well-worn brown boots were upon his feet. The old man's round, bald head shone above a beard that was mostly silver, but striped here and there with strands of its original golden hue, the skin round his sapphire blue eyes crinkling like old parchment as he smiled.
"Hello, Rockturner,"
replied Simon.
"It's good to see you again."
Daniel rushed across the room and embraced the old man. Simon was a priest, wise man and wanderer. For many years, Simon would come and rest from his travels at the home of Argius. He always brought a gift in his bag for Daniel, sweets or a tin flute when Daniel was very young, but later maps or books telling of faraway places. Though Simon was a priest, he was tied to no formal order.
"I serve the Lord as he pleases, not as man pleases,"
was how Simon explained his calling. Simon had called Daniel Rockturner, for that is how the priest first saw him as a boy, turning over rocks to see what was underneath. Daniel spent many an hour walking with the priest, learning the names and habits of the small creeping things of the forest. Daniel had not seen Simon since his 16th summer and his leaving for war college.
"Tankards, and time to drink them,"
ordered the king. Servants came, poured the 3 men ale, and left them.
"Well now,"
said Argius after half their tankards had been drained, getting caught up as old friends do.
Simon said that he has news of great import for Azulon, and that you should be here to hear it.
I have grave news for you, for your house and for all of Azulon,
began Simon.
Daniel, have you heard of the Guild of Wealthy Men who call themselves the Builders?
Yes,
nodded Daniel.
They are the heads of the wealthiest houses in Azulon and the Unicorn Kingdoms.
You've spoken truly, but not completely. They had many of the wealthiest houses, true, but more importantly, they had the oldest of the houses of wealth. They are owners of mercantile exchanges, banking houses, makers of the apothecary powders that physicians use, and many other things. They've become kings in their own way, for their treasuries, though lesser than their realms, are ruled by fewer men, and therefore more focused, and thus have a greater ability to accomplish the things those men set out to accomplish. With their wealth, they build up men who agree with their goals and tear down men who would hinder them. They have no army, yet many powerful men heed their call. Senators and centurions, magistrates and ministers, priests and patriarchs. Many who had risen to high office and having risen remain there, come to the Builders' Guild seeking its favour. And favour is given, but not without a price. Just a hint here, a suggestion there, then a demand, and finally, when they have their victims addicted to their aid, a command. Do as we order, or the gold you need to remain where you are shall disappear.
And ever it has been thus, from the founding of the first city upon the earth, said Argius. Only the king is not beholden to such men for our office, but even the crown feels their power. For the Builders' Guild and the men like them control many in the High Senate, and it is the Senate which controls the treasury of this land.
And yet,
said Simon,
even the High Senate knows it must please the people of Azulon to keep their seats. With those seats, the keys to that treasury. Therefore, they do not do all that the Builders bid them do, at least not openly or quickly. Instead, the Senate is ever trying to strike a balance between pleasing those who elect them and pleasing those who fund the election. Azulon's freedom has depended on that balance of forces for many years. But the Builders' Guild now has a plan to upset that balance, to lay a subtle snare for the people of this land, and once that snare is tight around their necks, bring them under a cruel enslavement.
Simon took a deep breath and looked skyward, as if in silent prayer, before continuing.
King Argius, here then is the danger that I would speak to you of. The Builders' Guild, these uncrowned kings of wealth, may not sit openly upon the throne here in Azulon, but they have other ways to rule. In the Unicorn Kingdoms across the sea, when they have not attained the crown outright, they rule from behind the throne as firmly as if they did sit upon it. They mean to do the same in Azulon, but first the people must be lulled into a dependency on them. They have begun such a task in Unicornia, starting in Gaul. There, all the people are given a tattoo that bears their census number. The people of Gaul carry no silver or gold, but when making a purchase, show the tattoo to the merchant, and the amount is taken from the purchaser's banking house and transferred to that of the seller.
Argius's eyebrows knit together as he heard this.
But how can this work? How can a merchant know the amount in a man's account just from seeing a tattoo? He cannot send a runner to the banking house each time a purchase is made. The method you describe would be like taking a letter of scrip from a stranger. No merchant would conduct business that way.
The guild has found a way to do this, though this was not their own doing, for they had help from dark places. To answer your question more directly, at each merchant's store is a black box, hexagonal in shape, with a round window set in the top and about half a cubit in diameter. When a customer's hand is placed atop the box, something within it reads the number of the tattoo. This information is then sent quick as thought itself to a similar box at the banking house of both the customer and the merchant. Taking the amount of the purchase from the account of the customer and transferring it to that of the merchant.
Surprise and more than a little wonder showed on the king's face.
Though these boxes are strange, they seem a boon rather than a cause for alarm, said Argius. No cutpurse could take your money unless he wanted to cut off your hand and try to buy something by passing that bloody piece of meat over these boxes.
The problem is threefold, began Simon, with each succeeding danger leading to the next. First, though the guild will claim that they have invented a device to make this type of communication possible, there is nothing in these boxes but trinkets, a few mirrors and lenses, a small brass bell, and some tiles made of coloured glass. Things to fool the simple should a box be broken open. No, the secret of the boxes comes from the dark arts, from sorcerers whom the guild is in league with. Second, in Gaul the king has forbidden the use of gold, silver or copper coin in that realm. The only way to buy or sell is through the black boxes and the tattoos. And last, the guild knows that many people will not take a mark upon their bodies. Therefore, their plan is to begin with this.
With that, he laid a thick bronze medallion on the table.
The banking houses will use these first, as a test of the black box system. People will wear these medallions and use them in place of the mark on their hand, which the men of Builders Guild hope will prepare them for the eventual use of that mark. Look at the medallion. I was told that the three numbers at its centre are always the same.
The king picked up the medallion and examined it. A puzzled look came over his face.
What is it, father?
Asked Daniel.
Look at this and tell me what you see, replied the king, handing his son the medallion.
Daniel felt its weight in his hand. Not a small amount of bronze was used in its manufacture. It was about a third larger than a gold sovereign, the largest coin used in Azulon. The medallion had a small hole set near the edge. He supposed this was for a cord, so that the piece could be worn hung from the neck, though its weight would make it cumbersome to do so. The side of the medallion facing him had a broad gouge running across it, obscuring whatever design was intended to be shown there. So he turned the medallion over, and on this side there was an imprint, and the sight of it caught his breath in his throat. Three hexagons, descending in size and each set within the other. Within each hexagon were six numbers, so that there were three sets of six numbers. At the centre of the smallest hexagon were three numbers, 6, 6, and 6. The numbers were written in old northern runes, little used now, perhaps as a way to hide their meaning.
It is the trihex,
said Daniel, placing the medallion down on the table and pushing it away from him.
Why would they choose such a symbol?
Yes, why indeed? Why choose a symbol that, for all those who worship the one God through his son Yeshua, is a symbol of the greatest evil that will ever walk among men? Why? Because the knowledge that the Builders Guild uses to power these black boxes comes from the servants of that very same evil.
Who?
Daniel asked.
Men who call themselves the Illuminati. The name means the Enlightened Ones, and it is a name I thought had died out long before I was born. But I should have known. A name may die, but the idea behind it will live as long as men wish it so. The Illuminati could rightly be said to have started when man first raised a tower at Babel and shook his fist at the heavens and cried out, "You have no right to rule over me." Anywhere and any time men have gathered to oppose God, or, if they did not believe in him, then opposed the worship of him by others, there, at that time, is the Illuminati. The Enlightened One's an ironic name, for what we call light, they call darkness, and acts we would call pure evil, they call pure freedom. The Illuminati are a group of sorcerers who look upon the Lord God as the great tyrant, are the enemy of God and man, who we know as Abaddon the Destroyer. They call Abaddon the Disenslaver. Their power comes from knowledge given to them by Abaddon in exchange for blood sacrifices and the selling of their souls. The black boxes are evil, because the makers of these boxes are evil and have built evil into their very design.
Yes, agreed Argius.
just as it is known that the fruit of a poisoned tree will also be poison. Yet while no Yeshuan would willingly take the mark of Abaddon's servant upon themselves, what of others? What would you say to those who do not believe as we do? For to many it is just a number, and see no evil in this mark.
There is a great danger to this system of boxes, medallions, and marks that even those who do not follow Yeshua should fear. The information taken with these boxes can be given to anyone. But it is one man in particular that poses the greatest danger to Azulon's freedom if he receives such knowledge.
Who is this man? Demanded Argius.
The Builders' Guild will offer that information to you, O King. And you would then know of every transaction by every person in the realm. You could then say to any banking house, remove authority to buy or sell from any man I consider an enemy. Let not one copper's worth of credit pass to them. No one rich or poor, great or small, could buy or sell unless he had the permission of the king. The coin of the realm would be outlawed, as would trade in silver and gold. Anyone the king deemed an enemy would face two choices: submit to the king's will, or starve.
Simon watched to see what Argius would make of this news, for how he reacted would show the true mettle of the man. The king sat in silence for a long, thoughtful moment before speaking.
Even if the use of the trihex is mere coincidence, this system places far too much power in the hands of even a good king, and kings are not always good. The more power a king has, the more he comes to believe that he deserves that power and that no one else is as wise or as strong or as just as he. The kings of the old world thought that since the king's judgment was never questioned, then all that the king did was right. If I have done it, then it was destined that it be done, was their motto. They began to think of themselves as gods. My forefather Asa once said, the best of governments would be run by a good king with absolute power, and the worst of governments would be the one run by an evil king with absolute power. Therefore, Azulonian freedom has rested on the middle road, that all power shall not rest with the king, but be divided between the throne, the senate, the high court, and the people.
Argius rose to his feet and began to pace the room, something he did, Simon knew, when he was preparing a plan of battle.
Safety for the people's freedom lies not with the absolute power being in the hands of one man, but it being thinly spread among as many as possible. These black boxes of the Builders' Guild concentrate power in the hands of one, the one who controls the black box. It must not be allowed on these shores.
Simon came to his feet and bowed before Argius.
King Argius, well are you called the wise by your people. Now the Builders' Guild, through its Azulonian head, Sargon of the House of Stone, wishes to bring their black boxes and this system of commerce here to your realm.
After what you have told me, do you think I would allow that system here? Said Argius.
You may have little choice in the matter, for that which has always restrained the king of Azulon from doing as much evil as he wishes, also restrains him from doing as much good as he wishes. Remember, Argius, you have already used up your one law when you limited the senator's terms in office.
Father, have you used your one law already? Asked Daniel in surprise.
Yes, on the very day after my coronation, replied Argius with a chuckle. I used my one law to order that a senator may hold no more than 2 terms in office. Since this law only pertained to those elected after it was made, the old men of the Senate thought themselves safe from its effects and did not bother to vote against it in the allotted time. After all, has not the defeat of a sitting senator been as rare as a hen's teeth for the last 40 years or more? Then, 3 months after my coronation, came the elections and many new candidates came forward saying, vote for me as I am one of you. And so they were. For farmers and small merchants, physicians and teachers now ran for seats that seemed not as sweet a prize to the power-hungry and greedy. And the people of Azulon said to themselves, I think Senators Gladhand and Backslap have been at their jobs too long. They may have come to do good, but they stayed to do well, and did much too well for their own purses. It's time to let some new blood into the Senate. And that's exactly what the people did, but no one foresaw to what extent they would do so. Better than half of the old Senate was voted out.
The king smiled, as a man remembering the fall of those who thought themselves invincible may smile.
Oh, I can tell you there was no little weeping of eyes and gnashing of teeth in the halls of the High Senate that day. I should tell you that most of the losses came from the Phlebian party.
Well now, this being the party that claimed to love the common people, but who loved levying taxes upon them even more, the Senate was now ripe for a change in the laws governing taxes. The patricians proposed doing away with all the old tax laws from the High Senate's own laws down to those of the smallest village, and making one tax law for all of Azulon, a law upon the sale of a good or service.
The most onerous of the old laws was the tax on income, which was collected before a single copper of a man's pay was given to him. The terms of this tax were ever changing and complex. It hindered savings and caused many a normal and honest man in Azulon to hide his income so he could pay a reasonable amount of taxes and still have something left to raise his family.
So then, the new tax was collected only at the sale of an item or service. The monies collected were then evenly divided between the county in which the sale was made, the province in which the county resided, and finally, the realm's treasury. The new tax was simple, understandable, and open, and the people of Azulon have prospered because of it. The savings and accounts of common people are up, and so are the treasury's funds.
But father,
said Daniel,
do you now regret using your one law so soon into your reign?
Argius shook his head.
I know that most kings have saved their one law, keeping that supreme weapon in reserve, for it's the only law a king can make that requires a unanimous vote of the highest senate to overturn.
Yes, my son, now with my one law spent, if just 2/3 of the senators voted against me, they could block any law I propose. This is the law of Azulon that has kept us a free people, but it has also kept the king weak. And yet, because I have used my greatest weapon when my reign was fresh, and those who might have opposed me, unsure of my purposes, there are now many new men in the Senate that I may call upon to put their realm's concerns before their own. Let me speak with them and find a way to defeat this plan of the Builders' Guild,
the sorcerers of the Illuminati, and the evil one they both serve.
We require a law that somehow forbids these black boxes without speaking of them directly.
For I fear that if the Guild gets wind of how much we know, any law we give the Senate would be doomed before the first vote on it was taken.
Azulon by William R. McGrath. Copyright 2007, William R. McGrath. Narration by James H. Brinkley. For more information on this book series, please go to www.theswordoffire.com.